Part 1 of Chapter 10 of John Brown by W. E. Burghardt Du Bois. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Great Black Way. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound. Halfway between Maine and Florida, in the heart of the Alleghenies, a mighty gateway lifts its head and discloses a scene which, a century and a quarter ago, Thomas Jefferson said was worth a voyage across the Atlantic. He continues, "You stand on a very high point of land. On your right comes up the Shenandoah, having ranged along the foot of the mountain 100 miles to find a vent. On your left approaches the Potomac in quest of a passage also. In the moment of their junction, they rush together against the mountain, rend it asunder, and pass off to the sea." This is Harper's Ferry, and this was the point which John Brown chose for his attack on American slavery. He chose it for many reasons. He loved beauty. "When I met Brown at Peterborough in 1858, writes Sanborn, "Morton played some fine music to us in the parlor, among other things, Schubert's Zirenada, then a favorite piece, and the old Puritan, who loved music and sang a good part himself, sat weeping at the air." He chose Harper's Ferry because the United States Arsenal was there, and the capture of this would give that dramatic climax to the inception of his plan, which was so necessary to its success. But both these were minor reasons. The foremost and decisive reason was that Harper's Ferry was the safest natural entrance to the Great Black Way. Look at the map. The shaded portion is the black belt of slavery, where there were massed in 1859 at least 3 of the 4 million slaves. 2 paths led southward toward it in the east, the way by Washington, physically broad and easy, but legally and socially barred to bondsmen. The other way, known to Harriet Tubman and all fugitives, which led to the left toward the crests of the Alleghenies and the gateway of Harper's Ferry. One has but to glance at the mountains and swamps of the South to see the Great Black Way. Here, amid the mighty protection of overwhelming numbers, lay a path from slavery to freedom. And along that path were fastnesses and hiding places easily capable of becoming permanent fortified refuges for organized bands of determined armed men. The exact details of Brown's plan will never be fully known. As Ralph says, John Brown was a man who would never state more than it was absolutely necessary for him to do. No one of his most intimate associates, and I was one of the most intimate, was possessed of more than barely sufficient information to enable Brown to attach such companion to him. A glance at the map shows clearly that John Brown intended to operate in the Blue Ridge Mountains, rising east of the Shenandoah, and known at Harper's Ferry as Loudoun Heights. The Loudoun Heights rise boldly 500 to 700 feet above the village of Harper's Ferry, and 1,000 feet above the sea. They run due south and then southwest, dipping down a little the first 3 miles, then rising to 1,500 feet, which level is practically maintained until 25 miles below Harper's Ferry, where the mountains broaden to a dense and labyrinthical wilderness and rise to a height of 2,000 or more feet. Right at this high point, and in sight of High Knob, a peak of 2,400 feet, began, in Fauquier County, the Great Black Way. In this county in 1850 were over 10,000 slaves and 650 free Negroes, as compared with 9,875 whites. From this county to the southern boundary of Virginia were a series of black counties with a majority of slaves, containing in 1850 at least 260,000 Negroes. From here, the Great Black Way went south, as John Brown indicated in his diary, and undoubtedly in the marked maps, which Virginia afterward hastily destroyed. The easiest way to get to these heights was from Harper's Ferry. An hour's climb from the arsenal grounds would easily have hidden 100 men in inaccessible fastnesses, provided they were not overburdened. And even with arms, ammunition, and supplies, they could have repelled, without difficulty, attacks on the retreat. Forts and defenses could be prepared in these mountains, and before the raid they had been pretty thoroughly explored and paths marked. In Harper's Ferry, just at the crossing of the main road from Maryland, lay the arsenal. The plan, without doubt, was first to collect men and arms on the Maryland side of the Potomac, second, to attack the arsenal suddenly and capture it, third, to bring up the arms and ammunition, and, together with those captured, to cross the Shenandoah to Loudoun Heights and hide in the mountain wilderness. Fourth, thence to descend at intervals to release slaves and get food, and so retreat southward. Most writers have apparently supposed that Brown intended to retreat from the arsenal across the Potomac. A moment's thought will show the utter absurdity of this plan. Brown knew guerrilla warfare, and the failure of the Harper's Ferry raid does not prove it a blunder from the start. The raid was not a foray from the mountains, which failed because its retreat was cut off, but it was a foray to the mountains, with the village and arsenal on the way, which was defeated, apparently, because the arms and ammunition train failed to join the advance guard. This, then, was the great plan which John Brown had been slowly elaborating and formulating for 20 years, since the day when, kneeling beside a Negro minister, he had sworn his sons to blood feud with slavery. The money resources with which John Brown undertook his project are not exactly known. Sanborn says, Brown's first request in 1858 was for a fund of $1,000 only. With this in hand, he promised to take the field either in April or May. Mr. Stearns acted as treasurer of this fund, and before the 1st of May, nearly the whole amount had been paid in or subscribed, Stearns contributing $300, and the rest of our committee smaller sums. It soon appeared, however, that the amount named would be too small, and Brown's movements were embarrassed from the lack of money before the disclosures of Forbes came to his knowledge. From first to last, George L. Stearns gave in cash and arms about $7,500, and Garrett Smith contributed more than $1,000. Merriam brought with him $600 in gold in October. Between March 10th and October 16th, Brown expended at least $2,500. In all, Sanborn raised $1,000 for Brown. Hinton says, as near as can be estimated, the money received by Brown could not have exceeded $12,000, while the supplies, arms, etc. furnished may have cost $10,000 more. Of course, there were smaller contributions and support coming in, but if the total estimate be placed at $25,000 for the period between the 15th of September, 1856, when he left Lawrence, Kansas, and the 16th of October, 1859, when he moved on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, with 21 men, it will certainly cover all of the outlay except that of time, labor, and lives. This total, however, does not include a fund of $1,000 raised for his family. The civic organization under which Brown intended to work has been spoken of. The military organization was based on his Kansas experience and his reading. In his diary is this entry: Circassia has about 550,000. Switzerland, 2,037,030. Guerrilla Warfare, see Life of Lord Wellington, page 71 to page 75. Mina. See also page 102, some valuable hints in same book. See also page 196, some most important instructions to officers. See also same book page 235, these words, deep and narrow defiles where 300 men would suffice to check an army. See also page 236, on top of page. This Life of Wellington, W.P. Garrison states, was Stockwiller's, and the pages referred to tell of the Spanish guerrillas under Mina in 1810, and of methods of cooking and discipline. In one place, the author says, "Here we have a chaos of mountains, where we meet at every step huge fallen masses of rock and earth, yawning fissures, deep and narrow defiles, where 300 men would suffice to check an army." The Alleghenies in Virginia and Carolina were similar in topography, and for operation here, Brown proposed a skeleton army which could work together or in small units of any size. A company will consist of 56 privates, 12 non-commissioned officers, 8 corporals, 4 sergeants, and 3 commissioned officers, 2 lieutenants, a captain, and a surgeon. The privates shall be divided into bands or messes of 7 each, numbering from 1 to 8, with a corporal to each, numbered like his band. 2 bands will comprise a section. Sections will be numbered from 1 to 4. A sergeant will be attached to each section, and numbered like it. 2 sections will comprise a platoon. Platoons will be numbered 1 and 2, and each commanded by a lieutenant designed by like number. 4 companies composed a battalion, 4 battalions a regiment, and 4 regiments a brigade. So much for his resources and plans. Now for the men whom he chose as co-workers. The number of those who took part in the Harper's Ferry raid is not known. Perhaps, including active slave helpers, there were about 50. 17 Negroes reported as probably killed are wholly unknown, and those slaves who helped and escaped are also unknown. This leaves the 22 men usually regarded as making the raid. They fall, of course, into 2 main groups, the Negroes and the whites. 6 or 7 of the 22 were Negroes. First in importance came Osborne Perry Anderson, a free-born Pennsylvania mulatto, 24 years of age. He was a printer by trade, well-educated, a man of natural dignity, modest, simple in character and manners. He met John Brown in Canada. He wrote the most interesting and reliable account of the raid, and afterward fought in the Civil War. Next came Shields Green, a full-blooded Negro from South Carolina, whence he had escaped from slavery after his wife had died, leaving a living boy still in bondage. He was about 24 years old, small and active, uneducated but with natural ability and absolutely fearless. He met Brown at the home of Frederick Douglass, who says, "While at my house, John Brown made the acquaintance of a colored man who called himself by different names, sometimes Emperor, at other times Shields Green. He was a fugitive slave who had made his escape from Charleston, South Carolina, a state from which a slave found it no easy matter to run away. But Shields Green was not one to shrink from hardships or dangers. He was a man of few words, and his speech was singularly broken, but his courage and self-respect made him quite a dignified character. John Brown saw at once what stuff Green was made of, and confided to him his plans and purposes. Green easily believed in Brown, and promised to go with him whenever he should be ready to move." Dangerfield Newby was a free mulatto from the neighborhood of Harper's Ferry. He was 30 years of age, tall and well-built, with a pleasant face and manner. He had a wife and 7 children in slavery about 30 miles south of Harper's Ferry. The wife was about to be sold south at this time, and was sold immediately after the raid. Newby was the spy who gave general information to the party, and lived out in the community until the night of the attack. John A. Copeland was born of free Negro parents in North Carolina, reared in Oberlin, and educated at Oberlin College. He was a straight-haired mulatto, 22 years old, of medium size, and a carpenter by trade. Hunter, the prosecuting attorney of Virginia, says, "From my intercourse with him, I regarded him as one of the most respectable prisoners that we had. He was a copper-colored Negro, behaved himself with as much firmness as any of them, and with far more dignity. If it had been possible to recommend a pardon for any of them, it would have been for this man Copeland, as I regretted as much, if not more, at seeing him executed than any other one of the party." Lewis Sherrard Leary was born in slavery in North Carolina, and also reared in Oberlin, where he worked as a harness maker. An Oberlin friend testified, "He called again afterward and told me he would like to keep to the amount I had given him and would like a certain amount more for a certain purpose, and was very chary in his communications to me as to how he was to use it, except that he did inform me that he wished to use it in aiding slaves to escape. Circumstances just then transpired which had interested me contrary to any thought I ever had in my own mind before. I had had exhibited to me a daguerreotype of a young lady, a beautiful appearing girl, who I was informed was about 18 years of age. But here Senator Mason of the Inquisition scented danger, and we can only guess the reasons that sent Leary to his death. He was said to be Brown's first recruit outside the Kansas Band." John Anderson, a free Negro from Boston, was sent by Lewis Hayden and started for the front. Whether he arrived and was killed or was too late has never been settled. The 7th man of possible Negro blood was Jeremiah Anderson. He is listed with the Negroes in all the original reports of the Chatham Convention, and was, as a white Virginian who saw him says, "of middle stature, very black hair and swarthy complexion. He was supposed by some to be a Canadian mulatto." He was descended from Virginia slaveholders who had moved north, and was born in Indiana. He was 26 years old. Of the white men, there were, first of all, John Brown and his family, consisting of 3 sons and 2 brothers of his eldest daughter's husband, William and Dauphin Thompson. Oliver Brown was a boy not yet 21, though tall and muscular, and had just been married. Watson was a man of 25, tall and athletic, while Owen was a large, red-haired, prematurely aged man of 35, partially crippled, good-tempered, and cynical. The Thompsons were neighbors of John Brown and part of a brood of 20 children. The Brown family and theirs intermarried, and Anne Brown says that William, who was 26 years of age, was kind, generous-hearted, and helpful to others. Dauphin, a boy of 22, was, she writes, "very quiet, with a fair, thoughtful face, curly blonde hair, and baby blue eyes. He always seemed like a very good girl." The 3 notable characters of the band were Kagi, Stevens, and Cook, the reformer, the soldier, and the poet. Kagi's family came from the Shenandoah Valley. He was 24, had a good English education, and was a newspaper reporter in Kansas, where he earnestly helped the Free State cause. He had strong convictions on the subject of slavery, and was willing to risk all for them. You will all be killed, cried a friend who heard his plan. Yes, I know it, Hinton, but the result will be worth the sacrifice. Hinton adds, I recall my friend as a man of personal beauty, with a fine, well-shaped head, a voice of quiet, sweet tones that could be penetrating and cutting, too, almost to sharpness. Anderson writes that Kagi left home when a youth, an enemy to slavery, and brought as his gift offering to freedom 3 slaves whom he piloted to the north. His innate hatred of the institution made him a willing exile from the state of his birth, and his great abilities, natural and acquired, entitled him to the position he held in Captain Brown's confidence. Kagi was indifferent to personal appearance. He often went about with slouched hat, one leg of his pantaloons properly adjusted, and the other partly tucked into his high boot top, unbrushed, unshaven, and in utter disregard of the latest style. Stevens was a handsome 6-foot Connecticut soldier of 28 years of age, who had thrashed his major for mistreating a fellow soldier and deserted from the United States Army. He was active in Kansas and soon came under John Brown's discipline. Why did you come to Harper's Ferry? Asked a Virginian. He replied, It was to help my fellow men out of bondage. You know nothing of slavery. I know a great deal. It is the crime of crimes. I hate it more and more the longer I live. Even since I have been lying in this cell, I have heard the crying of slave children torn from their parents. Cook was also a Connecticut man of 29 years, tall, blue-eyed, golden-haired, and handsome, but a far different type from Stevens. He was talkative, impulsive, and restless, eager for adventure, but hardly steadfast. He followed John Brown as he would have followed anyone else whom he liked, dreaming his dreams, rushing ahead in the face of danger, and shrinking back, appalled and pitiful, before the grim face of death. He was the most thoroughly human figure in the band. One other deserves mention, because it was probably his slowness or obstinacy that ruined the success of John Brown's raid. This was Charles P. Tidd. He was from Maine, 27 years old, trained in Kansas warfare, a nervous, overbearing, and quarrelsome man. He bitterly opposed the plan of capturing Harper's Ferry when it was finally revealed, and, as Anne Brown said, got so warm that he left the farm and went down to Cook's dwelling near Harper's Ferry to let his wrath cool off. A week passed before he sullenly gave in. Beside these, there were 6 other men of more or less indistinct personalities. 5 were young Kansas settlers from Maine, the Middle West, and Canada, trained in guerrilla warfare under Brown and Montgomery, and thoroughly disliking the slave system which they had seen. They were personal admirers of Brown and lovers of adventure. The last recruit, Merriam, was a New England aristocrat turned crusader, fighting the world's ills, blindly but devotedly. The Negro Lewis Hayden met him in Boston, and after a few words said, I want $500 and must have it. Merriam, startled at the manner of the request, replied, If you have a good cause, you shall have it. Hayden then told Merriam briefly what he had learned from John Brown, Jr., that Captain Brown was at Chambersburg, or could be heard of there, that he was preparing to lead a party of liberators into Virginia, and that he needed money. To which Merriam replied, If you tell me John Brown is there, you can have my money and me along with it. These were the men, idealists, dreamers, soldiers, and avengers, varying from the silent and thoughtful to the quick and impulsive, from the cold and bitter to the ignorant and faithful. They believed in God, in spirits, in fate, in liberty. To them, the world was a wild, young, unregulated thing, and they were born to set it right. It was a veritable band of crusaders, and while it had much of weakness and extravagance, it had nothing nasty or unclean. On the whole, they were an unusual set of men. Anne Brown, who lived with them, said, "Taking them all together, I think they would compare well," she is speaking of manners, etc., "with the same number of men in any station of life I have ever met." They were not men of culture or great education, although Kagi had had a fair schooling. They were intellectually bold and inquiring. Several had been attracted by the then rampant spiritualism. Nearly all were skeptical of the world's social conventions. They had been trained mostly in the rough school of frontier life, had faced death many times, and were eager, curious, and restless. Some of them were musical, others dabbled in verse. Their broadest common ground of sympathy lay in the personality of John Brown, him they revered and loved. Through him, they had come to hate slavery, and for him, and for what he believed, they were willing to risk their lives. They themselves had convictions on slavery and other matters, but John Brown narrowed down their dreaming to one intense deed. Finally, there was John Brown himself. His personal appearance has been often described several times in these pages. In 1859, he was the same striking figure, with whitening hair, burning eyes, and the great white beard which hardly hid the pendulous side lips of Olympian Jove. One thing, however, must not be forgotten. John Brown was at this time a sick man. From 1856 to 1859, scarce a month passed without telling of illness. His health was some improved in May 1857, but soon he lost a week with ague and fever and left home feeble. In August he wrote of ill health and repeated returns of fever and ague. In September and October his health was poor. The spring and summer of 1858 found him not very stout, and in July and August he was down with ague and too sick to write. In September, he was still weak, and although some improved in December, the following spring found him not very strong. In April, amid the feverish activity of his fatal year, he was quite prostrated, with the difficulty in my head and ear, and with the ague in consequence. Late in July, he was delayed with sickness, and there can be little doubt that it was an ill and pain-racked body which his indomitable will forced into the raid of Harper's Ferry. Having collected a part of the funds and organized the band, John Brown was about to strike his blow in the early summer of 1858, as we have seen, when the Forbes disclosures compelled him to hide in Kansas, where the last massacre on the Swamp of the Swan invited him. He left Canada for Kansas in June 1858. Cook, somewhat against the wishes of Brown, who feared his garrulity, went to Harper's Ferry, worked as book agent and canal keeper, made love to a maid, and married her, and then acted as advance agent, awaiting the main band. 10 months after leaving Canada, and in mid-March 1859, John Brown appeared again in Canada, as has been told in Chapter 7, with 12 rescued slaves, as an earnest of the feasibility of his plan. He stayed long enough to spread the news, and then went to northern Ohio, where he spoke in public of Kansas and slavery. He said that he had never lifted a finger toward anyone whom he did not know was a violent persecutor of the Free State men. He had never killed anybody, although on some occasions he had shown the young men with him how some things might be done as well as others, and they had done the business. He had never destroyed the value of an ear of corn, and had never set fire to any pro-slavery man's house or property. He had never, by his own action, driven out pro-slavery men from the territory. But, if occasion demanded it, he would drive them into the ground, like fence stakes, where they would remain permanent settlers. Brown remarked that he was an outlaw, the governor of Missouri having offered a reward of $3,000, and James Buchanan $250 more, for him. He quietly remarked, parenthetically, that John Brown would give $2.50 for the safe delivery of the body of James Buchanan in any jail of the free states. He would never submit to an arrest, as he had nothing to gain from submission, but he should settle all questions on the spot if any attempt was made to take him. The liberation of those slaves was meant as a direct blow to slavery, and he laid down his platform that he had considered it his duty to break the fetters from any slave when he had an opportunity. He was a thorough abolitionist. Then he went east to see his family and visit Douglas, where he met and persuaded Shields Green, and to consult with Gerrit Smith and Sanborn. Alcott at Concord wrote, "This evening I heard Captain Brown speak at the town hall on Kansas affairs and the part taken by them in the late troubles there. He tells his story with surpassing simplicity and sense, impressing us all deeply by his courage and religious earnestness. Our best people listened to his words, Emerson, Thoreau, Judge Hoar, my wife, and some of them contribute something in aid of his plans without asking particulars. Such confidence does he inspire in his integrity and abilities. I have a few words with him after his speech, and find him superior to legal traditions, and a disciple of the right in ideality and the affairs of state. He is Sanborn's guest, and stays for a day only. A young man named Anderson accompanies him. They go armed, I am told, and will defend themselves if necessary. I believe they are now on their way to Connecticut and farther south, but the captain leaves us much in the dark concerning his destination and designs for the coming months. Yet he does not conceal his hatred of slavery, nor his readiness to strike a blow for freedom at the proper moment. I infer it is his intention to run off as many slaves as he can, and so render that property insecure to the master. I think him equal to anything he dares, the man to do the deed if it must be done, and with the martyr's temper and purpose. Nature obviously was deeply intent in the making of him. He is of imposing appearance, personally. Tall, with square shoulders and standing, eyes of deep gray, and couchant as if ready to spring at the least rustling, dauntless yet kindly. His hair shooting backward from low down on his forehead, nose trenchant and Romanesque, set lips, his voice suppressed yet metallic, suggesting deep reserves, decided mouth, the countenance and frame charged with power throughout. Since here last, he has added a flowing beard, which gives the soldierly air and the port of an apostle. Though 60 years old, he is agile and alert, and ready for any audacity in any crisis. I think him about the manliest man I have ever seen, the type and synonym of the just." End of part 1 of chapter 10.